West Coast, the East Coast, and deep in the heart of Texas. It's the Geek at Arms podcast with Brian, Mike, and James.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Geek at Arms podcast, a podcast about three guys who share a lot of geeky hobbies and also a love for the Lord our God. I'm James, and with me are my good buds, Mike and Brian. Mike, how are you doing today, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you, Brian?
I am feeling pretty good this week. James?
I am glad to be here recording with you two. It has been a crazy month. It has flown by, and not because of fun, but because of sheer frantic busyness. August has become the busiest month of the year, and coincidentally, most expensive month of the year, for my family. We had a family trip out of state, then had to make up work because of it. School was starting. All three of our children have birthdays this month. My wife and I have our anniversary, and more. Also, August being the hottest month of the year in Texas, which is always fun to deal with. I've honestly never looked forward to September so much.
Yeah. Speaking of it being an expensive month, do you have to pay fees and stuff to get your kids into school in Texas?
Just some, like, small basic fees that just cover a couple of things, like not very much at all. Is that different up in your neck of the woods?
Oh, like here? Well, I used to live in Illinois, and there were fees everywhere. When I moved to Massachusetts, I was amazed because you just kind of show up and your kids go to school. And that's it. And it's lovely. Now, if you at the high school, if you rent a locker, then there's a locker fee. But, I mean, that's like nearly nothing. But some people are paying hundreds of dollars to put their kids in school. Public school.
That doesn't seem right to me. Because then they're defined if they don't send them to school, so...
Well, then you have to fill out paperwork to explain why you are not able to pay fees and so forth. So it varies state by state. So I was just curious.
Yeah. I know that, I mean, she already started school this past week, but no, public school in Texas is tuition free. And there are some small expenses, but it's minor. It's minor enough that I don't even remember how much it was.
Gotcha. You just mentioned putting the kids in school, so I was...
Well, kid in school. The two younger ones are still in daycare, but...
Yeah,
and that does cost. I am passionately, passionately looking forward to the day that they start kindergarten, and people always say, oh, no, treasure these small moments. I'm like, no, grow up and get into kindergarten. You guys are costing me a mint. Doesn't matter where you're at. Daycare is expensive. Someone once asked me, what are you going to do? And I know they were talking about my mental state, but what are you going to do when all three kids are in school? And I replied back, buy a new house. First, I'm going to take a long vacation, and then I'm going to buy a new house.
Put all that stuff back out of the pawn shop.
So, Brian, anything new and interesting in your neck of the woods?
Well, not a whole lot. I started one of my coworkers talked me into a writing partnership. So once a week, we go over to a coffee shop and ask each other questions about the books that we're supposed to be writing.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah, it's lighting a fire under me to actually start writing again. I hadn't done it in a couple of years other than the technical writing that I'd been doing.
Well, I, for one, would be interested in reading what it is, whatever it is you come up with.
Well, if I ever get out of chapter 3 on one of these books, I'll let you.
Fair enough. Mike, anything new and interesting with you?
Well, something that doesn't fit into our geeky things, something that is wonderfully new. My wife surprised me with a date to the theater.
Ooh.
And not the movie kind.
The theater.
So, yes, indeed. And we went to go see my absolutely guilty pleasure, Hello, Dolly. And it was grand.
Oh, wonderful. That's a great one.
I don't think I've ever seen that one.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. I know I have to hand in my geek card to admit how much I love this cheesy film. But it is such a delightful farce. And yes, it's sexist, but it also kind of is farcically sexist. Like they sing a song about the place of a woman in the home. And of course, she's supposed to sweep the ashes and, you know, clean up after dinner. But it just keeps getting grander and grander, and like, and shovel out the stables and reshoe the horses and fix all the plumbing. And like, this crotchety, curmudgeony character's vision of what he wants in a wife. And in no part is there any love ever mentioned. So, I mean, it's just so ridiculously over the top that it gets a pass. I mean, it's like the Saturday morning cartoons of musicals. Bright colors, lots of dancing, and nothing serious, and yeah.
Now, you get to keep your geek card, because you can make the argument that it stays with you, because Hello, Dolly! Was featured, not prominently, but quite a bit, in the animated movie WALL-E.
Absolutely. Man, it was such a wonderful deployment of the music, too.
It was, wasn't it?
And I think that Ashley from MinMax is going to just take umbrage at the notion that theater weakens your geek cred.
No, no. It's a strong point in favor of geek cred.
I would think so, no. Yes.
Theater doesn't diminish your geek cred, but just
that particular show?
Or your taste in theater? Show, yeah. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that when I knew one of the ushers when I went in there, and she knew all of my preferences, and she was like, oh my gosh, is Mike going to like this? I mean, this is way outside his normal wheelhouse. And I'm like, no, I love it. And I knew I'd love it.
You really could have included that in your geek out, and it wouldn't have been out of place at all.
Okay, well, do it in post. Fair. Just kidding. Do not do that.
No, but we will head straight to Geek Out, and I'll kick it off this week. Why do I say this week? We don't do this on a weekly basis. I'll start us off this...
Sure, we do it on a weekly basis, but only 1 in 4 makes the cut.
There you go.
Yeah, throw out 75% of what we do.
The rest of it's pure trash. We just phone it in. I'll start us off this episode. So, speaking of the MinMax podcast, I was listening to a recent episode, and Kyle was leading a discussion on the lore and the religious system found in the game Skyrim, a game that I have loved for years. I mean, I played it on the Xbox 360 when they remastered it and released it on the Xbox One. My wife bought it for me again. I've logged a lot of hours. I love it, but... they were discussing the pantheon of gods found in the game, specifically about the Nord Talos, who led his people to victory over invading high elves and later would become a god himself. And the discussion of that got me thinking, when was the last time I played Skyrim? Now, because of this busy last month, I have had like little or no video game time. Like, I get home and I either work on a project that I will discuss in a moment, or I'm straight to bed.
Yeah, so you haven't played Skyrim since you took an arrow to the knee?
Well, that would have been when I got married to Joy, is I think what that
yeah,
is
that
an
marriage
analogy
ceremony
for.
Was brutal.
It's seriously. But this past week, since listening to that episode, I popped Skyrim in, and I promptly found myself with no clue of where I was or what I was doing. Yeah, I kind of felt like Gandalf in the Mines of Moria, looking around going, I have no memory of this place. Thankfully, it didn't take me long to familiarize myself, because, you know, I looked at my last save game and it had been a year. I thought, I'll just do one side quest and I'll call it good.
6 side quests later.
Well, yeah, not only did I not finish that side quest, but I now have 2 more right after that. And really, in a nutshell, that is Skyrim.
Yeah.
I also took some time to just look around, because this is my first time playing. It's not my first time playing it on the Xbox One, but it is my first time playing it on our new television that we bought a year ago, which was a 4K TV. And wow, was it pretty. Kind of.
And you can't even get any of the mods that make it even prettier, can you?
Yeah, I can. Okay. A lot of those are now available on the Xbox.
Nice. I didn't know they allowed modding.
Mm-hmm. The one addendum is that once you start adding mods, you are not available to get any of the achievements for the game. So with this second playthrough, I'm only about halfway through the game, and so I'd still like to get a lot of the achievements, but I've been looking through a lot of the different mods that are available, And some of them are absolutely silly, like we talked about in an earlier episode. But some of them, their whole point is just to make an already great-looking game look even more beautiful. And some of those I'm really looking forward to putting in. I do have a few months until the next game that I'm interested in comes out. And while I have my first playthrough, I finished both the main storyline, the Civil War side story, and a lot of the DLCs, I never finished the last DLC that Bethesda came out with, which focused on the very first Dragonborn. So there's still quite a bit of unknown content for me to discover, and that's got me excited and hoping that I can wrap it up in the next couple of months. But what I alluded to earlier, when I wasn't either sleeping or going through the land of the Nords, we were back in Kansas again recently, this time for an SCA event. My friend John Bowyer, who I've talked about maybe once or twice on this podcast, he had his vigil at the Barony of Batavia's Tournament of Valor for his elevation to knighthood.
Oh, congratulations to him.
Now, we've known John, his wife Lillian, and their children for about 12 years. We met them when we were living in Colorado Springs. We became good friends and neighbors. Just love his entire family. We love them like family. And so when his wife, Lillian, told us about his upcoming elevation, we actually knew before he did. We knew that we had to be there. We actually ended up missing a local event that happened here in Texas, but we just had to be there. There was no question. We were not going to miss it. Not something this important. Now, John plays a 14th century Englishman, and he wanted his vigil area, his vigil tent, which took place all day on Saturday, to be as period as possible. There was period food for the visitors to eat, or as close as we could get it. Decorations, the furniture, all were pretty accurate, and it was a great kind of living history display area. Now, to go along with this, I bought him some reproduction 14th century English pennies, groats, and quarter nobles that all date to the time of King Edward III.
That's really cool.
These are from a period coin maker named James Kaufman through his website Alpha Officium. Now, he looked at period examples of coins and made the dies for these coins himself, and then started stamping them and selling them. And he's a great artisan, a really great gentleman, and I've bought stuff from him on many occasions. Whether you want English coins, French, Spanish, German, Japanese, Byzantine, Roman, and more, he probably has an example of it on his website.
Now, all right, so if you do want to do any actual time travel, you know the people to go to.
Or if you end up running a more period medieval role-playing game and you'd like to have some coins to use as in-game currency or for counters, luck tokens, or for whatever scenario you can envision, it's a great place to get a period-appropriate prop.
Sounds interesting.
Now, in addition to the coins, I present them to him as saying, I've been to the court of King Edward, I told him about your upcoming elevation, and I produced a miracle. I got your back wages. And I got a nice leather coin pouch, which I put them all in. I have witnessed and produced for you a miracle. I got your back wages. And I threw it to him. Now, in addition to the coins, for both him and for his period display, because I do enjoy doing woodworking from time to time, I researched and I built for him a period board game called Alquerque. Alquerque, I believe I'm pronouncing that right. Actually, I am probably pronouncing it wrong, but we'll move on. It's also known
as Albuquerque.
Yeah. Also known as Kerkat. It's a strategy board game that is thought to have originated in the Middle East. It's considered to be the parent of draughts, or in the U.S., we know them as checkers. And I found an example of it in the 14th century English manuscript called The Romance of Alexander.
Hmm.
Now, in this manuscript, beside the usual scenes of hunting and fighting and wooing, there was also several illuminations of people playing games, which included chess, Nine Man's Morris, and Alquerque. And here soon I will post a picture of the game because, hey, it's a period board game. And that will wrap up my geek out.
Over to you, Mike.
Well, There's quite a lot on my geek out this time around, so I'm going to keep the first few things brief. The first is that lately I have been playing a lot of, I find this title really unfortunate. The title of the game is New Super Mario Bros. Wii U Deluxe. Like, come on, Nintendo. Let's break this down. First of all, it's a deluxe version of a previous game. So still keeping new in the title really isn't doing anything for you. Do you know what? This was a bad idea when you did it for the Wii. Never put new in the title because it's not going to be new forever. But now it is because it's New Super Mario Bros. Wii U Deluxe. It is really similar to the initial New Super Mario Bros. Wii. It's a redo with special options of the Wii U version. But really, the gameplay of this, for some reason, the level design, it just really allows me to zen out as I fly through the levels. And, I mean, usually I'm not a super-duper hardcore, let's do this fast. But something about this game just encourages me to fly as fast as I can to do some of these. And if I'm playing solo, my family members will watch me and will gasp, and you'll hear sudden intakes of breath as the art of my character is intersecting the pixels from enemy art, but not quite hitting the hitboxes. And so my eldest will be shrieking, and my wife is going as I'm just going through these in just a couple of minutes, and like, this is painful. I can't watch. And I've got 90, 80 lives. I'm like, how much have you been farming? I'm like, none. The one-ups are just so easy to get here. And so I have just a casual disregard for my own life. So if I die 11 times, it just means that I do it better on the 12th and not slowing down at all to do it. So it just kind of breeds this style of play. But usually that sort of thing will ramp up my tension. But this time around, it seldom does. Like, there's no anxiety or fight or flight. It's just, I don't know, zen out and do it. So it's been a nice de-stressor for most of the levels.
I've seen a few of those levels that people have created with just look like death incarnate.
Okay, and that's in Mario Maker.
Okay, that's Mario Maker, different thing, because I've watched those and I get stressed out just by watching them. So I was going to say kudos to you, but this sounds like a different game then.
It's a different game altogether with the similar mechanics, but what really does get to be a mess is that it's four player simultaneous. And so when you have more to pay attention to on the screen, some levels it makes it so much easier because you have kind of ingrained save points. Like, if you die, but somebody else keeps going, then you can respawn on the screen. But other times it's just trying to keep track of too many things as people are bumping into each other. And it's not something you can really be frustrated at because at least not for me. Other people definitely have a different story. Different people in the room have a different story. There are times that we're doing this and I'm like, oh man, I am so glad they're still making episodes of the Three Stooges because this is great. Just bumping into each other, accidentally jumping onto each other or interfering with each other's jumps. So both people or one of them wind up going into the lava, and it's just funny. It really is.
Sounds like the kind of game that I would have enjoyed playing with my sister.
Yeah, especially because you can actually be, like, if you really want to be mean to each other, you can. Like, you can pick each other up and you can throw one another. And there was one time my wife just had it in for me, and it was, my spidey sense tangled. I mean, she just ran at me. It was the start of the level, so there was no real clue that she was going to do it. She ran at me and then hit her pickup button. But I had jumped backwards over her just before she had done that. And the pickup button is also the same as the spin jump button. So instead of her throwing me into the lava, she just jumped and plopped right into the lava. And we were just laughing for 5 minutes of the poetic justice.
Well, my sister and I were always of the more chaotically cooperative type, where we're trying to help each other out, but just can't.
Yeah. My wife and
Here,
I are very
I'll,
much
I'll
like
throw
that.
You across the gap. Oh, no, I threw you into the gap. I'm sorry.
My youngest and I actually have pretty good synergy most of the time, and we can we can coordinate. But I think that she and I have the best help each other out at the expense of ourselves mentality of anybody else in the family. And it just works. But otherwise, it's just three stooges or four stooges, and it's fun. Apart from that, I took my youngest to her first con last Saturday, and we went to Boston Fan Expo.
Very cool.
It was a bit of a culture shock for her because she's heard about cons, but she's never been to one. And this whole idea that you approach strangers and you ask them, first you compliment the stranger, then you ask if you can have a picture taken with said stranger, is so out far of any cultural training that there was some anxiety and some hesitation, like, is this okay? I'm not sure I want to do this. And I'm like, that's fine. You don't have to do this, but here's the camera. Would you please take a picture of me with Iron Man? Because the fact that this guy's face mask is mechanized and opens and closes with twitches of his fingers is amazing. And this is going to happen, and it's going to happen on my computer screen. So here's the camera. Here's me with a stranger. But after she was invited to sit in a Star Wars freighter lounge and take pictures with a couple of bounty hunters, things changed really quick. So she really got into it, and on the way home was saying, Dad, can this be my birthday present for next year? And we're like, yeah, I think that we can work this out. That will happen.
Awesome. Did she come away with any cool swag?
We were pretty slim on the swag. There wasn't anything in the way of swag bags unless you bought a deluxe pass. And I kind of did this one on the cheap because I didn't know what the experience was going to be.
I should have replaced the word swag with like mementos or just anything cool from the vendor area.
Yeah, we looked at a lot of vendors, but there wasn't anything that she saw that she wanted to spend her money on because she's saving up for something else. And I want to value this, hey, we see all these neat things and we can prioritize the long term over the short term. So I think that she made a lot of wise choices.
Good for her. Well done. Because some people get in there, they have a plan to save for something long term, but they see all the new cool stuff that they don't usually see, and sometimes those ideas go right out the window.
Yeah, she played this one really well, and she had a great time. We went to a panel, and we learned a lot very quickly because it was an improv of a familiar script with some voice actors, and when one of the voice actors came out with Filthy Elmo, we're like, okay, now it's uncomfortable. If we get up and leave, will it make it more uncomfortable because we have to acknowledge that these things are okay? Yeah, they did warn us that it was PG-13 to R, but I'm like, okay, if they stay closer on the PG-13 end, we're fine. Like, oh no, that's R. Okay, no, that's very R.
Time to
okay,
bail.
That's very, very, very R. Okay. Okay. Yeah, you warned us. That's on us, not on you. We should have pulled the plug earlier, but we're not gonna hit that next year. But before Filthy Elmo showed up, it was actually really good. Anywho, I actually just finished reading a really wonderful, fascinating text called 3 Mile an Hour God by Kosuke Koyama. And I don't usually talk about my theological reading on this podcast, but, you know, I think that going theology geek is on par. And it's fascinating because it is a practical theology written from a non-Western perspective. Mm. And I say practical theology because rather than it being a highly philosophically formulated systematic theology, it's a theological examination and a higher calling to give some examination to areas of praxis. So it's a series of essays, and it's extremely accessible and very well written. And it is written from, as I said, somebody that brings a non-Western perspective. Earlier in the text, he says that the East must learn its theology from the West, and the West must learn its theology from the East. And the general structure of the writing is really interesting, but also his style of thinking is really fascinating. He says that he learned about faith through the teachings of Buddha, and that he calls that his first language of spirituality. But then he also relates the salvation that he had through through faith in Christ as his second language. And so it's primarily Eastern underpinnings that guides his thinking to provide a valuable distinctiveness to the writing. So it's fundamentally Christian and fundamentally Eastern. And if you've listened to the podcast for any length of time, you know how much I enjoy exploring some of the philosophical and sociological foundations to the formulations of our everyday thought. So exploring a text where the concepts are of a greater importance that's informed so differently than mine was a really valuable read for me. And so all these essays are really different from one another, but there are some themes that arise. So, for example, he calls into question the Western isms that we use to classify generally other faith systems, such as Hinduism and Shintoism and Zoroastrianism and Judaism, leaving unsaid that we call it Christianity rather than Christism. So these things first and foremost set up the otherness of faith while owning our own Christianity. There's some things that he leaves just barely under the surface, like it's these underlying mentalities of the otherness affects evangelism as a paternalistic endeavor to westernize as much as introduce Christ into the culture. So rather than introduce the salvific love of Christ, we need to impose Christianity over these other isms. And so
that's always been
really,
something that bothers me about Western missionary work.
As well
Sorry
it should. No, that's not interruption. That's a valuable point because it is something that we should be called to struggle with more and find more valuable ways of interacting rather than reacting with the colonialism and the Western imposition of thought and culture. Because one of the things that he, again, never quite says is that evangelism and mission work is often a matter of colonialism rather than sharing the love of Christ. And I can point to several examples of how that's happened, but that perhaps is another discussion. So he wrote the text in the mid to late 70s, but there is so much that is still very current, even in the American culture. So particularly in terms of his concepts of social justice. So I really recommend 3 Mile an Hour God by Kosuke Koyama.
Now, let's include a link to that book in the show notes.
Oh, absolutely. I'm putting Roger. It on my reading list right now, too.
Now, I will say this, that this is a collection of essays. So some of these are very different from each other, and I've highlighted some of the ones that were most interesting to me. So your mileage will vary throughout the book. And he does certain things. The book is structured, so he kind of turns up the temperature slowly on his critique of Western thought. Like, he doesn't lead with that. Especially the times through which he lived really give a fascinating take on his understanding of Japanese culture and of Christian thinking. So, I mean, he lived through World War II and through the Reconstruction, and it's an amazing read.
Well, I am looking forward to that one. It sounds right up my alley.
Same here.
I also recommended it to one of the podcasters that we have in our network, and I hope to at some point hear her take on it. I won't name her just yet, but you know what, I'm calling you out when you hear this. calling you out. The last point of my geek out, because I know I've gone long here, folks, and I apologize for that, but not too much. I have been talking with the wonderful people at the Retro Rewind podcast, and by the time this actually makes it out of editing, you should head on over to our discussion of Alien. And I say our because I will be guesting on the Retro Rewind podcast. They
nice.
Are
oh, very cool.
Yeah, they were kind enough to open the door to their time ship for me, and I will be climbing on board, and we will be reviewing the movie Alien.
You know, that has never been a favorite of mine. It's not even one that I have watched all the way through, but I'm going to listen to it just for your take.
Yay. I mean, I haven't seen it either. It's not scary, is it?
Not at all.
But yet, from what I understand, the film starts with the fundamental plot structure deals with a nice hug. So I see no way this film could go wrong from there.
I mean, it is a sci-fi classic. Horror movies really don't freak me out. Thrillers don't either. But there's something about the monster from Aliens which just pushes all the right fear buttons with me.
It was specifically designed to freak out straight white guys. So it's got just an extra level of...
I mean, anything with H.R. Giger being involved, I mean, it is designed to hit all of those buttons. And I say it tongue-in-cheek. I've seen the film. I mean, I know what this is about. But I'm looking forward to sending my synopsis, especially just because of who has played in the film before. And I know that you're supposed to be brief with the synopses. And I'm really looking forward to participating.
You know, once upon a time, H.P. Lovecraft said, no one could think of weirder and creepier stuff than I. And H.R. Giger comes along and says, hold my beer.
Yeah, my beer is poured into a human skull. I have a collection. I'm not making that up.
No, I've seen pictures of the dude's house. You're completely real.
Yeah, he used to tug a human skull along behind him on a string when he was young. So I'm like, yep, here we go. All right, well, that will do it for my geek out.
All right, I guess that leaves me then. So I recently finished the game Limbo. Have either of you played that one?
No.
I think Mike, you'll probably would enjoy it. It's a side-scrolling platformer with a puzzle-solving layer to it. And it's just really broody and atmospheric and kind of freaky in places, but it was a nice game. It took me a while. It was one of those where I'd get stuck and I'd get frustrated and I'm sick of this. I'm done with it. I'm not playing this anymore. And I put it away for a week or two, and then I'd say, I want to finish that game, and I pick it back up, and then suddenly, like, I had subconsciously solved whatever it was that was in my way, and I could play for a while longer. It was an interesting and peculiar experience. I recommend it.
It looked really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And it's all in that just monochromatic grayscale. It's hard to say what the story actually is. There is one there, but it's vague. So it's just the kind of thing that we tend to enjoy talking about. What actually happened at the end? I don't know.
Would you say that it's safe to have with children around, or is it really dark?
I would say 8 years and up. Okay. There's a few places that are scary, and it gets a little gruesome. Not like gory, but, oh, gee, the little kid has a spike through his head now. Ugh. Okay. So kids that are sensitive, I would say, wait a while, but...
Well, that kind of stuff happens now in My Little Pony, so...
Yeah, it's funny because I'm scrolling through these, and they have a My Little Pony intruding into the Limbo game. So not sure what's going on with that image.
Interesting.
That's some weird DLC from that studio, I gotta say.
Oh my gosh, and also one of the robots from Castle in the Sky. So yeah, this is an interesting mashup.
I've been spending a lot of time lately knitting together a lot more of the other Christian geek communities. With the Gamers Guild, I published about 6 months ago a list of our friends and allies, just trying to find all of these different organizations, find how do you get in contact with them, what are they doing. And a day after I published that, a dozen more came out of the woodwork. Hey, we want to be on that list too. So
nice.
I added those to it, and I thought, you know, with the nature of the internet and these communities being kind of ephemeral, I should republish this every half year or so, just to stay on top of things. And as a consequence of all of the stuff that I've been doing on Twitter related to the podcast, I've run across, I think, at least half again as many more groups than were in that original thing. And I've added, I categorized it now, and I've added categories for people who are doing streaming ministry, a couple of conventions. I spent so much time just researching and pulling that together, and I've had my head buried in that for a while. And as you guys know, there's there's been a lot of conversation going on between the various Christian geek ministries and groups on Facebook and on Twitter. It's been really interesting to see just how much there is out there. I knew there was a lot, but it's overwhelming amount of stuff and more popping up every day.
In your research, have you found that, and in terms of at least the Christian gaming geek community, that in fact Mike Perna is the sitting Archduke, or is it just my perception?
He does tend to be sitting at the center of a number of different webs. His name will pop up all over the place. I don't know if you'd want to ascribe him any particular feudal responsibility and privileges as a result of that, but.
But how about a shiny hat? Can we at least do that?
I think a shiny hat would be more than appropriate, yes.
And it's one it's one that he would adopt eagerly.
He will wear it to every convention, I'm sure.
I have a feeling if we tried to crown him with a shiny hat on our podcast, he would like, I don't know about the title sitting Archduke, but we put the shiny hat on him anyway. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Right?
This is like, shh, Mike, this is happening. This is happening, Mike. There you go. Right on your head.
Right. So that's been a lot of fun to poke at all of those nooks and crannies, finding more people. And I'm sure a lot of them will be surprised that, they're on the list now. I'm sure a lot of them aren't even aware that there is a list. But we'll see how that goes and see if it stirs up even more of them to come find me. And speaking of Twitter, this isn't really like an entry in the geek out, but I've had it on my list for a while. I just want to say that there's an awful lot in the world to dislike, and there's an awful lot of Twitter to just say, oh gosh, I wish that wasn't there. But I love the fact that I now live in a world that enables a geophysicist to be famous.
Yeah.
Agreed.
I've been following Micah McKinnon, and she's delightful. She's got a great sense of humor. She posts interesting things. And for the most part, the conversations around what she writes are positive. And just like, you know, 15 years ago, you couldn't have said, oh, yeah, the famous geophysicist, that phrase wouldn't exist. But now it does.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that.
That's a beautiful thing.
Are there any other people like that you follow on Twitter, Mike?
I'll say this, that I do find a lot of really interesting people that I will follow. And it's also kind of a balancing act because I do the Geek at Arms Twitter and my personal Twitter. And mm-hmm. So as of late, I've been focusing more heavily on Geek at Arms. So, you know, in terms of, is there anybody on that level of the, you know, in those spheres, who in the Christian geek? And, wait a second, we're just talking about Mike Perna, weren't we? And I'll leave it at that.
Right. Well, it's an interesting new dynamic that it really is, in some ways, a meritocracy where somebody who knows what they're talking about and has something worthwhile and useful to say actually does now have a place in which to say it, and they can get an audience. You know, throughout most of human history, that hasn't been the case. But now it is. And yeah, it comes along with an awful lot of awfulness. But I think on balance, of course, I'm hopelessly optimistic. So I think it's a good thing, generally speaking. Of course, then I also mute an awful lot of words and people on Twitter, so I don't see the worst of it. And moving on, the last item on my geek out list is math.
The return of math.
Math 2. I don't have a subtitle for that.
Even mathier.
I've been doing a lot more programming at work, and I researched how to make what's called a Bezier curve, which if you've ever used Photoshop or Illustrator and you've got the pen tool, you got the points and the handles, and it's very confusing until you learn how to work it. Well, I built one of those. So I had this problem in the software I use, Fusion, where it can make a Bezier curve, but it can't make it taper. And a lot of times, you know, if you're just trying to do like a pen stroke or something, you want it to taper out into a nice fine line, and Fusion couldn't do that. And I've been asking for years to the developers, saying, hey, could we get a tapered spline? Every time there's a request for what features do you want to see, I said, tapered splines. And they just won't do it, so I decided to make my own. And so I started looking into that, and it turns out that the Bezier spline is this awful, awful, just giant, hairy polynomial So I had to start learning my algebra again. And
giant hairy polynomial. That really sounds like a good college band.
That's right, you know.
So, I thought that was the Tolkien monster, but
I think that was Fritz Lieber wrote about the giant hairy polynomial. So learn the algebra, learn the calculus, and get that done. And so I've just been kind of had my head buried in that math for a while. And it's been a lot of fun for me and everybody else just kind of looking at me funny, which I'm really glad that we're doing this, you know, totally by voice. It's just the podcast, and I can't see you guys looking at me funny.
Oh, you would have seen something a lot blanker from me than you would have expected. I dropped for a minute there.
Yeah, so it's even more confusing to you because you don't have the context of what I was talking about, right?
Absolutely.
That's okay. It wouldn't have made any more sense with the context either.
I'll just catch it live. I'll just catch it in the episode.
And that wraps it up for me, too. Do you guys have anything else you wanted to talk about on the Geek Out?
I did not, Mike. You?
I shouldn't. I mean, no. I thought for a second because my kids just finished. We finished reading up Fellowship of the Ring together, and they just watched the movie of Fellowship of the Ring. So
was that their
was a ride.
Was that their first viewing of the movie?
Absolutely.
They've had
a spoiler-free life.
Wow. Well done.
I wish I could go back to then.
It was really interesting viewing the film through their eyes because they're like, oh, Dad, this went really fast. It was 3 hours, but that moved fast.
Yeah, they won't say the same thing at the end of Return of the King.
Nope. Is it over yet? Well, no, okay. Is it over now? Wait, how about now?
Four more endings.
Four more?
And then they're going to be saying, oh my gosh, they're not doing the Scouring of the Shire, are they?
Now, did you do the theatrical release or did you do the extended version?
We started with a theatrical.
I think that's smart.
So just wanted to see how that would go.
Look forward to the day I can do that with my own.
You know, it's one of those things like you really just have to gauge the temperature with kids. Like some of them may be into it and some of them may not be. And if they're not willing to pick it up, then you just let it be and love them for who they are and then just rejoice when they do pick these things up.
Now, I found on Amazon a graphic novel version of The Hobbit. I thought that would be a great way to introduce my daughter into the Tolkien world because we could look at it together at night. And I was looking through it, like beautiful artwork. It looked really cool. And then it got to Gollum and I was like, holy cow, he's creepy.
He is creepy.
He is creepy, but his representation within this graphic novel was even bothering me. And I'm like, no, 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 I'm not showing this to my 4 or 5 year old daughter. Nope, I'll wait till she's a little older.
Let me see if I can find this graphic. Ooh, how old is she?
She's now 7. She might be.
Yeah, I'm looking this up online. He looks kind of like a Nosferatu, really.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, your mileage will vary, yeah. If that's what you think she can't handle, then don't give it to her.
I knew my daughter, and at that time when I got the graphic novel, I knew how she might react to that picture, and that made it a big fat no. I still have the graphic novel. She might do better now. I found out after her last visit with grandparents that they took her to go see Spider-Man Far From Home, and she was fine through that. So if she can deal with undead zombie Iron Man, I think she can deal with Nosferatu Gollum.
I mean, that's the thing, is just knowing where your kids' sensitivities are at, because it can be all over the place and make no sense. But, you know, there's always time to scar them later.
Absolutely right.
So, speaking of cartoons that scared us and scarred us as children, our topic this time on our Films Club series is The Secret of Nim. As we mentioned last time, we were going to tackle 3 animated films, and I wanted to ask you guys, first of all, why do you think, what's the importance of animated films specifically? Why are we talking about these?
Yeah, as much as it's not a genre, we get to treat it separately than we do, say, live action or other types of media, because there is something about the way that we engage animation that sets up an entirely different level of tolerances, entirely different levels of suspensions of disbelief. And I don't understand what that does, but you'll even hear TV animation producers and other makers of the art talking about, oh, you can push the envelope so much farther on an animated piece than you ever can in anything live action. Even if it's just the dialogue, for some reason, it engages our sensibilities differently. It engages our suspension of disbelief differently. And I think it's the latter thing that is more interesting to me, is that we can talk about this family of mice needing to move out of the home that's threatened to the plow without really questioning, well, if they're intelligent enough to speak and to communicate and develop elaborate plans, aren't they just smart enough to make a home that isn't affected by the plow to begin with? You don't ask those questions because they're mice and they're cartoons. Mm-hmm. And it just interacts with our brain differently.
I think animated movies are important because the first animated movies that came out dealt with mostly fairy tale, thanks to the popularity of the first Disney films, and they would keep it in that vein for quite a while. And animated movies at that time showed us things that were impossible with normal live-action films.
Yeah, we don't have to worry about how the special effects blended in with this.
Exactly.
The animation is just, it's the same thing.
It could show us the impossible. Therefore, I think it could show us greater tales of myth and legend. And it kind of helped expand our imaginations about what is and what was possible in real life and also on film. Now, true, we have entered into an era where, thanks to raw computer power, the special effects can match and even exceed what animation has traditionally done. There is still the foundation we get from animated films.
And there's still something that is unique to an animated film, particularly, in my opinion, the hand-drawn animated look that we've got.
I completely agree.
That even the most sophisticated computer animation is lacking. There's an appeal and a life to it that doesn't happen when something is photorealistic. Have you seen the trailer for this Lady and the Tramp that's going to be on Disney Plus?
I've seen pictures of it. Honestly, I'm not a huge fan of...
It doesn't look right,
yeah,
does it?
It doesn't. I'm not a huge fan of the live-action Disney remakes. I thought The Lion King looked like a Discovery special.
Mm-hmm.
I expected to hear the dun 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 dun.
And I think one of the things that's missing is that stylization that you get when you've got an actual animated film, something that's not intended to look like a real person or a real mouse. And you can make the eyes gigantic. You can give them expressions that are somewhere in between a person and an animal. And I think that the ability that you have to do that and to really personify these animal characters in an animated film is far superior to what we're seeing right now in all of these quote-unquote photorealistic live-action animated movies that they've been doing lately.
I just made the mistake of looking up the photorealistic Lady and the Tramp, and I feel uncomfortable. I need to take a station break.
Yeah, I look at them and I'm like, I need to call the Dog Pound or the Humane Society, pick these up. I do not want to serve them a plate of spaghetti.
Right. And I don't think I have the time to unpack why that makes me uncomfortable.
But
the cartoon, there's just a completely different emotional resonance with the material.
Mm-hmm. And you can tell stories that you can't tell in another way. In my opinion, I don't think that Aladdin works necessarily as well as it did as a cartoon. I think I really love animated films, and mm-hmm. I always have, and there's something about them that I find appealing and important in the whole sphere of film craft.
And not just animated movies, but speaking specifically about Secret of Nim.
Why don't we tell the listeners, if they haven't seen this film, a little bit about the film?
That's a good idea.
Secret of Nim was released in 1982. It was produced by Don Bluth, who was... Prior to creation of a new company to produce The Secret of Nim, he was a Disney animator. I believe that whoever brought the property to him to have it produced originally offered it to Disney, and they said, no, we've already done mouse movies. We don't want to do another one. And so Bluth actually left Disney to make this movie. And Of course, his bosses weren't happy because he was taking an awful lot of institutional knowledge with him. And along the way, he was apparently a reasonably well-liked guy. He also took about half the animators themselves.
Ooh,
with him.
Wow.
Whereupon so, Disney dispatched a team of assassins to try to do him in.
Right, so Disney did their best to downplay the movie to try and prevent it from being made. I don't know how serious they got. I don't think it was Barney level of killing it. If you're familiar with that, the mouse kind of quashed the popularity of Barney, or tried to anyway.
Oh, that I was not aware of.
Well, it didn't work hard enough.
Well, they apparently see other kids' properties sometimes as a threat and do what they can to prevent them from happening. Or at least they had in the 80s. And they tried with The Secret of Nim, but Bluth stuck to his guns. They actually had to, I don't know the entire story, but some of the money walked out on them. And so Bluth and a couple of the other producers actually had to mortgage their houses to raise the last little less than $1 million that they needed to finish it.
They made double their budget in the box office, so you know they did okay.
It definitely paid off, and it turned into a long career of 21 or more Land Before Time movies, two An American Tales, Dragon's Lair, Space Ace.
Yeah,
a number of other titles.
Those.
Wow.
So Bluth eventually did well off of that that second mortgage. I imagine it was a scary situation.
Did that studio also do Anastasia?
Yes.
Ah, gotcha.
Anastasia was also a Bluth. And A Troll in Central Park.
Titan A.E., if I'm not mistaken.
Titan A.E., which I liked a lot, but a lot of people apparently don't. I think it's an underrated film.
I like it for what it is.
Same.
Anyway, so that's where Secret of Nim sits in terms of its production, how it came to be. The producers actually wanted a PG rating for it and were surprised when it came back G.
Really surprised me as well.
Really? Mm-hmm. I assumed it was PG because of the
one epithet. Some of,
yeah. Jeremy's little potty mouth, yes.
Yes. That's what they were shooting for, but it came back G, and they thought that might have hurt them at the box office. It is a somewhat darker film in comparison to most of what Disney was doing at the time, The Black Cauldron notwithstanding.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's interesting that they passed it up when they would do their own kind of dark fantasy just 3 years later. Of course, Dark Cauldron is kind of like the forgotten Disney movie, to be honest.
Yeah, unfortunately, people don't remember that one very much. And I don't know, maybe The Black Cauldron was in response to The Secret of Nim. They saw, hey, this movie did pretty well. Let's give a darker twist to one of our own and see what happens. I don't know if that's the case, but it's certainly a possibility.
Because they had some pretty rich, dark environments in this film, and it were just gorgeous.
Yes. The background work on it was just fantastic. And it sounds like we're moving into the film craft.
Well, I did want to say one thing about why The Secret of Nim, why I view it as important. I think it's a perfect example of, well, not exactly lighthearted, because it is definitely a dark fantasy, but it's a simple and honest type of fantasy movie / animated movie that I view in the same vein as Willow, Neverending Story, Princess Bride, and more. These type of movies and this type of storytelling have become all but extinct in Hollywood these days, as the trend has slid more towards gritty realism, which is extended into pretty much all genres of film.
It seems like movies right now, the stakes are always end of the world, too.
Yeah.
You don't have stakes as low as, I have to move my house and save my kid.
Now, there are exceptions, but the only movies that have come out in the last decade or more that have made me feel the same sense of wonder and awe and that had that same feeling about them have been How to Train Your Dragons, which very nearly made this list. I mean, it was one of our top contenders for our animated film club. Tron Legacy and Ready Player One. Now, these are my own insights. These are my own feelings. These are my own thoughts. My own list of movies that made me feel this way, which means exactly jack squat to everybody else. But I do miss this type of storytelling that I view as being present within this movie.
I think you raise a strong point here, because one of the things that filmmakers generally resort to in order to get us to care is that A, it's the end of the world, or B, oh, look, I just killed the main character. Oh, wait, no, I didn't. Not for real. Just mm-hmm. kidding. Which is a really cheap way of trying to get an audience to care. Like, if you can't emotionally engage an audience without making them think that the world is going to end, or I just tricked you to think the main character has died, then you're just a sloppy storyteller. Like, you don't know how to emotionally resonate with people.
Yeah.
But here, the stakes are field mice might die. Might.
Yeah.
This field mouse needs to go across the field, or just another side of a stone. And those are the real world stakes.
To us, to our real world, it is nothing. It means nothing. But for these small little characters, it's their entire world.
And it is so big on screen, and it's mm-hmm. amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So the question that I have is there anything about the film craft of this particular movie that is interesting or distinctive?
Besides what Brian mentioned earlier about the beautiful traditional cell painting, what really took my breath away when I saw it again was the use of backlighting that they used to produce such bright lights, which, whether it was a character's eyes or the electrical lights of the Rat's City, it was breathtaking.
One of the things that the listeners might not be aware of is that when they were filming this feature, what they had done is when they laid the cells out, they backlit the cells while shooting it. So there are some scenes where you can see these vivid lights coming through, or the amulet is glowing, or one of the things that caught me this time is that the fireflies on the screen while Mrs. Brisby was singing were never drawn. The fireflies were just light underneath the cells that they were moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is so much they did to play with light that had nothing to do with the ink work that is just breathtaking in this film.
And they had to design some new cameras just to be able to do that, too.
So that's remarkable and beautiful. Yeah, the haunting light in this film always attracts my attention. When they shut the door from Mr. Age's lab, it just darkens the entire scene. And it's just because they turned off the backlights in conjunction with him shutting the door that showed you the contrast of this vivid, lively, energetic environment to what is just hand-drawn. So, I mean, props to Bluth in putting this together. It's just incredible.
Now, I did read that they used quite a bit of rotoscoping as well. I'm only familiar with it to the extent of what I've read. Can one of you explain for our listeners what the process of rotoscoping is?
Okay, so when you rotoscope, you film some real object or person, live action, and then you put the resulting image onto a light box and you trace over it. And this is what they did at Disney to get that characteristic dance that Snow White does, and then you see it later in Robin Hood, and you see it in several other places, where they had a woman who danced on film and then they just traced over her so that they could get a more fluid and more realistic kind of motion. It's been used a similar technique in where I noticed it most strikingly in this one was during the scene with the plow.
Yes.
And the farmer. And that was the same technique, I believe, that was used by Bakshi in his Lord of the Rings.
Yes, because that's exactly where my mind went mm-hmm. when I saw that scene.
I never noticed the rotoscoping. And that's usually one of the things that jumps out at me so strongly. Was it because they were just using it for the human element of the tractor? Or...
Well, in that particular scene, it was kept in the background. You're obviously way more focused on what the Shrew and Mrs. Brisby are doing in the foreground. And I'm not entirely sure how much rotoscoping that they used as animation reference, but one of the things that I noticed is a lot of the motions of the characters, their acting, particularly Jeremy the Crow, was so very lifelike and so fluid. And I don't know that they were using rotoscoping as animation reference for that, but it wouldn't surprise me if they were drawing over probably themselves, shooting some reference of expressions and gestures to get that look very, very authentic.
Speaking of the look and the animation, and what you said a few moments ago about the rotoscoping in Disney's Robin Hood, I would really be curious if the same animators and artists who worked on Robin Hood also worked on this, because that art style looks exactly alike.
Well, definitely a lot of the animators did come directly from Disney and would have been about that generation.
Now, we are dealing once again with anthropomorphic animals.
Right.
But I felt like I was watching Robin Hood 2, especially later when we get into Nim and we see the doublets and the tunics and the swords.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious about that, so I want to find out. Let's see, Robin Hood, and that would be 19...
While he's looking that up, I'll interject that that's one style of rotoscoping where you film something live and then trace it. There's a more difficult kind of rotoscoping where you just capture something live and try to trace over it on the cell. And that's really hard to pin down a crow while tracing over him. So that's, I mean, it's a lot, a lot more sophisticated technique.
Yeah, not recommended for beginners. That's an advanced technique.
And yeah, wear gloves. Definitely wear gloves.
But I think in particular the crow is really shows that they were looking at reference very, very carefully.
And you talk about a perfect fusion of excellent animation and excellent voice acting. Dom DeLuise as the voice of Jeremy the Crow.
Oh my God.
That was
his timing is perfect.
It's in my personal view, it's right up there alongside Robin Williams as the genie.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, there's a reason that he kept going back to DeLuise for all of his movies.
Mm-hmm. I believe I read somewhere that Bluth was one of those people who knew exactly how to get as much as he could out of Dom DeLuise. But Bluth admitted, whenever I have him on a shoot, I have to schedule at least 2 more days of filming because of all the laughter that is usually present when he's around.
Yeah. I mean, his comedic presence is just so perfect in this film, and he gives so much life to Jeremy that
it's
just wonderful.
That character could have easily have been an annoyance. It could have been a Jar Jar Binks type of character, but instead we get rich and varied and funny and adds to the spirit of the movie so much.
We've got more to say on him when we get to our character relationship section, so let's save that. But yeah, just absolutely wonderful performance from that actor.
I do have one more thing I want to say about the animation technique, and that was all of the effects animation that was done in this. Just stop and think for a moment how difficult it would be to draw fire and water splashing, smoke, all of these different things that they had that have to look like what they are, and yet they're totally amorphous.
Yeah.
And they nail it.
Yeah, it is so wonderful. All of the effects animation and the details like Jenner's cloak, the way it falls and the way it swirls when he turns. It's just amazing.
And the level of detail. I mean, once you stepped into Mr. Age's lab, I was just blown away when I'm really examining the film, especially because there is so much in Age's lab that has made a thing of wonder out of something commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't take a list of all the things that he had, but it's almost like you take buttons and thimbles and candles, and then suddenly you make something that is just otherworldly out of it. And they had such a wonderful, imaginative, yet still grounded in reality place. And I loved their settings for exactly that.
And did anybody stop to think about how much extra effort it took to do all of those reflections in the council room?
Oh my gosh.
Totally optional, and yet they did it anyway.
Yeah.
And you have to love them for that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, also, the gray owl in one of the larger scenes when Mrs. Brisby is entering into his chamber and the moth is flying up and as the spider is descending, if you know where to look, you can see the owl almost the whole time. He's there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I hadn't bothered to look for him. Interesting.
I just noticed him this time around. And I've watched this film so many times. But yeah, there he was. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Man, now I have to watch it again.
But they didn't.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't cheat. That's what's beautiful.
Oh, I was looking up earlier. There are 6 names in common between Robin Hood and Secret of Nim, Bluth being the chief among them.
That would explain quite a bit.
All right. So we've spent quite a bit of time on the film craft of this. I think that, James, you wanted to talk a little bit about medieval myth and legend.
Well, what I found very interesting was how they decided to represent the rats of Nim. I have not read the book, so I can't speak for how... Okay, in the movie, you get a very feudal feel from their society and how they act in their government structure and in their dress. Some are carrying swords. They have doublets on, cloaks. The council. Is it called the council?
I don't know if they ever actually said what they called that body.
Their government body. They are wearing 16th, 17th Renaissance era style robes and clothing. The main villain has a glorious cloak, which swirls around beautifully.
And a Flambeur sword.
Yes. Now, Mike, do they give any indication of how these rats look and what their society looks like in the book?
It's been a long while, and I meant to reread it before the podcast, but I simply ran out of time. But my recollections are correct that it's a more mechanized society more than it is this fantasy level society. I mean, it's
because that would
certainly they are mechanized. They have electricity. They have elevators.
Yeah,
but I don't remember the feel being as...
Because that would fit with their background, that they were lab rats and lab mice who were experimented on and gained a high level of intelligence, so much that they were able to read and figure out how to work the locks and escape from the lab. Now, in the movie...
Because they did,
go ahead.
They did have a blending of kind of magic and science with the lab. Yeah. Like, they injected them, and suddenly they've received an injection, and they could read. I mean, there was a long, drawn-out process in the book.
But when you look at the rat's kingdom under the thorn bush, you see the modern elements in engines and electrical wire and lights, but the way that they are drawn and presented in this animated movie, it's a electrical, modern world viewed through a fantasy filter. It all
Absolutely.
Looks like something that could have been in a fairy tale. It got me thinking about maybe they were looking at these rats as the people of the Romantic era looked at medievalism. And they looked at medieval times in a very pure and noble, idyllic mindset. That this was an age of fairies and spirits, wild religion. The supernatural is present and walked hand in hand with the real world. And there was chivalry, courtly love, troubadours and legends of old, high and noble ideals, handsome knights, wizards, lofty castles, and more. And didn't concern itself with the reality of how the Middle Ages really were. Now, that's how the Romantics viewed it, and you see elements of that within this. It's like the rats, they had their taste of brutal, gritty reality, and the society they created was a romanticized version of a simpler time.
Maybe Nicodemus had been...
Yeah, maybe Nicodemus, after he learned to read, got a hold of a couple of Arthurian legends.
Just what I was going to say is he'd been reading Thomas Mallory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you look at the elements that are present. You have Nicodemus, the wise, elderly leader who is a wizard, who wants to lead his people to a safe, promised land where they no longer have to steal and can live in higher, pure, and noble ideals. I love that line that he gives Mrs. Brisby in the boat. We can no longer go back to being just rats. We know too much. That's good writing. And you have your noble hero knight archetype with Justin, who's very much, when I first saw him, I'm like, oh, it's the Robin Hood fox as a rat. You have a power-hungry, villainous, but very charismatic villain in Jenner. But then some of these ideals kind of fly out the window when we get to Mrs. Brisby. Because here we have the protagonist, who is a field mouse. She is the smallest of the small. She is at the bottom of the food chain. And yet she is the one who constantly braves things which would cause bigger animals than her to quail in fear and forces her to be resourceful and strong to face any danger for the sake of her children. And on top of it all, one of the biggest dangers she faces, a dragon. Whether or not he's furry or can breathe fire, for all intents and purposes, he is a dragon.
Yeah, she does have to face down the dragon, doesn't she? My goodness, the very thing that killed her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez. All right. Why don't we spend a little bit of time talking about Nicodemus? I mean, you brought him up. Let's explore that a little bit.
Something that I've seen this movie dozens of times, and Nicodemus has always kind of bothered me because he doesn't seem to really fit in the story very well. For one thing, where the heck did he learn the magic?
Exactly. I mean, exactly. What were they injecting into those rats?
Right. And that's kind of beside the point. I mean, the magic is, and it's there, and
Steve,
he uses it.
Steve, have you seen the bottle marked midichlorians? No.
Dang it, you beat me to it.
But he's kind of at the back, behind the scenes in this entire story. And I kind of just wonder how much of it is driven by his apparent prescience. And the thing that I picked up this time it's completely obvious, and I don't know why I didn't make the connection before, was that Nicodemus and the owl have the same eyes.
Mm. Mm.
And it was always curious, like, why does the owl care about Jonathan Brisby? Why does his name mean something to the owl of all people? And then I was realizing there's something else behind this story. There's another story that's not being told that's underlying all of it. And I find that really fascinating, and how it explains a lot that seems to be holes in the plot.
Well, it makes sense to me that they establish the character of Jonathan Brisby many times throughout the movie. We see how anyone who learns that she's his widow, they treat her one way, and then when they find out her name, they treat her completely different. In some cases, almost deference is shown to her. So that begins to establish the character of her husband. And the owl knows him. The rats, Nicodemus, knows him. And it shows this was a man of courage and kindness. After all the other mice had perished while they were escaping, he was the one who went through the grate and helped the rats escape. He could have just crawled through the grate and gone off on his own. But no, he stayed and he helped them escape. He volunteered to drug a dragon's meal for the other's safety, and he was killed for it. But those are two instances shown of courage and kindness on his part, so it is not a stretch to assume that there would be more instances that we just haven't heard or seen.
Well, because those two things don't say anything about the owl.
Yeah.
The only thing we get about the owl is that Nicodemus says, oh yes, he and I are long friends. And it's establishing this relationship that has nothing to do with any of the plot that we've seen. But as you said, there's more story under the story. How is it this wise old owl and this weird rat wizard have a longstanding friendship?
Yeah. And it could have been that Jonathan didn't do anything for the owl, but it's alluded to that the owl is wise and sees much. And it could have been that the owl just saw Jonathan being consistently kind and courageous and giving, and for that reason alone earned the owl's respect.
And then there was the matter of the stone and Nicodemus giving it to Mrs. Brisby.
Yeah, we get nothing on that.
And that's why I think that to some degree he must have been able to have some inkling of the future, to know that it was going to be important that she have it, because he didn't object at all when she volunteered to drug Dragon. And you would think if he's being... He knows that it's a huge risk that Jonathan died and Mr. Aegis broke his leg trying to do this, and that she will be in very real danger. But I wonder if he also knows that her facing this danger is the only way that she'd be able to wake the thing up.
Well, in that case, it's not so much of a stretch to believe that he saw his own death.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked into it willingly.
Another thing about the stone, though, is that this is a storytelling mechanic. The thing that, I mean, it's completely absent from the original tale. There was no stone in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it works well in a visual medium, that what we need to do is, and we'll talk about this a little bit more when we talk about Brisby's character development, but there is nothing that shows her courage in terms of how to be the final agent of movement at the end of the film without some sort of magic involved, because she is, in the end, a field mouse. She has no pulleys. She has no winches. She's a mouse. But once you hand her something that amplifies her courage into something actionable, then there you have a resolution. So I think that in essence, it's a mechanic, and you need more magic around the stone for the stone to fly in the narrative. But I think that in the context of this film, it works.
Mm-hmm. So that was all I had to say about Nicodemus. Do we want to move on ahead into Brisby?
I think it's an excellent place to go. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. I'm chomping at the bit, Mike. Go for it.
Oh, man. Here's the thing, is that this film really is about a powerless field mouse who feels desperate. She's lost her husband. She is afraid of losing her child, but is willing to take small steps to do what she needs to do to save her son. Her first encounter is, you know, with this generally benign environment that tends to explode now and again when she goes to visit Mr. Ages. They amp up this tension as she meets Jeremy, and she's still not really an agent of change. She's reacting to an environment around her. And it isn't until we see this desperate situation of the plow coming that she first initiates being an agent of change. The tractor is an insurmountable force of destruction. All of the animals run wild trying to get to their, you know, it's moving day. Everyone is terrified, much like moving day in Boston in September the 1st when all the students move in. Somebody's driving a moving truck down Starrow Drive, and we tell them not to, and they ram it into a bridge, and everybody who's a resident just runs and screams, the students are here, it's moving day, run for your lives. But what she does is she takes matters into her own hands. This is insane. She disables the tractor.
She doesn't, though. She fails to disable the tractor.
Oh,
the shrew
does
that.
It is. You're right. So there, she isn't even an agent of change yet.
She tries, but she fails.
Right.
That's still important.
I think that is probably more fundamentally important than if she had succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
Because what she has to do is consult somebody who thinks who can be an agent of change. So she summons her courage and goes to visit one of the top predators in the field.
To which she mentions that several times, but owls eat mice.
And even Jeremy is terrified of this guy. I don't think owls eat crows, but he is shaking in his boots, metaphorical boots, and is hiding from the owl as the owl leaves. But yet she walks right into this guy's lair, terrified, and seeks a gatekeeper of knowledge. And that gatekeeper of knowledge says, go consult this other gatekeeper of knowledge. And that gatekeeper of knowledge says, what we will do is we will move your home. But still, these are acts of courage until we get to something that is absolutely unnecessary. She volunteers to drug the dragon, and at great risk to herself, and is even captured in the attempt. But then things flip. Once she's in that cage, she becomes the gatekeeper of knowledge. She overhears the phone call that Nim is coming to destroy the rats. And at that point, rather than waiting to be rescued, as she does in the book, what does she do? She starts becoming the agent of change. She engineers her own escape and then makes it to the site where she is the fundamental, ultimate agent of change. So she is the one who rescues her family through this narrative of her building courage and actually finally having success in the end. Which, I'm sorry, that is brilliant storytelling. I mean, there are problems with this film, but I don't even have time for them because this is such a fundamentally wonderful structure of storytelling.
Even though there's never really a mention of a prophecy, her journey is prophetic in a way. Because,
you know, it kind of is because Nicodemus predicts that she was going to be the one that saves them.
Yeah. So you look at the sequence of events. It's moving day. Her son is sick. She goes to the owl for help. The owl sends her to Nicodemus. She discovers about the rats, about Nim. She hears their story. Nicodemus says, we will help you, but someone will have to... Normally we'd have someone drug the rats so that way we can be out to help you. She doesn't have to. She volunteers to do so. In doing so, she hears about the fact that Nim is coming for the rats. She would not have been in that place had she not gone to them for help and them not agreeing to help her. A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D. She hears it, she comes. Nicodemus, unfortunately, dies, but it seems that Jenner is going to take power and says, we will stay here as we always have. But her revelation leads for him to show his true colors and for Justin to show his strength and to take his place as the rightful leader, and with the knowledge that she brings, is able to save his people from the threat of Nim.
Do you find it at all interesting that Mrs. Brisby doesn't have a name, nor does
Yes.
Mr. Ages?
I've always thought that was kind of weird.
But we have somebody who is, I mean, this is about her narrative and her strength and her courage, yet we don't even know what her first name is.
And her husband, Jonathan Brisby, is the only one with two names. Everyone else goes by a single name. Justin, Jenner, Nicodemus.
And that one guy who doesn't have a name at all, apparently.
Yeah.
His name is Sullivan, according to the credits.
Who is that one? Oh,
Jenner's henchman.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. See, even Brutus gets a name, and he doesn't even get a line.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that Mr. Ages also has a first name, but we don't know. It's just Brisby and Mr. Ages.
It's less jarring to me that he is never referred to by his first name because he has that elder position in the story, the place of respect. And so it makes sense to me that everybody calls him Mr. Ages.
You could
somebody would call her by her first name.
You could just as easily replace the Mr. with a professor or even doctor or some other label of academic authority.
Like, oh, come on. Where did he go to grad school?
MU, Mouse University.
I was at MIT, Mouth Institute of Technology.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have one, sorry. Wait, Ratcliffe. No, that's for women.
But you do raise an interesting point that Mrs. Brisby doesn't even really have her own name. Her identity could almost entirely be wrapped up in the fact that she's Jonathan Brisby's widow. And that's how people see her, except for the fact that she proves herself time and time again to be intelligent, thoughtful, brave, and one who perseveres through so much trial.
It is interesting that it is that fundamental relationship of someone who is deceased that really is driving the course of the narrative. And I think that maybe we should talk a little bit about some character relationships to Mrs. Brisby, if we have room for that. One of the things that struck me most was Jeremy's relationship to Mrs. Brisby. And part of this is wrapped up in some of the things that are innate to this whimsical, silly crow. But there's something more to him than just being whimsical and silly. Have you noticed that the bravado that he shows to Mrs. Brisby, that he is like, no, I'm just hanging out. I'm just working out. Like he can't admit that he screwed up so badly that he got himself tangled and he can't get himself out. He wants to look like he's under control, except interviews with, pardon me. I really feel like what we have is, at least at this first meeting, we don't have just a comic relief. We have somebody who's in some ways looking for a mentor. He's trying to build a lady's nest. He doesn't know the first thing. And he starts looking to her for advice. And it's like, well, you're a girl. You could tell me about these things. And one of the things I find is so interesting about this initial meeting is, you know, he's insecure. He's constantly trying to make up for his screw-ups. He's constantly apologizing for himself. And then even asks, do you like me? And she initially begins this conversation with something very familial. Like, of course I like you. Despite the fact that you nearly got us both killed. But I feel like that relationship changes a little bit during the course of the narrative. But that relationship of this seeking a mentor of this field mouse was something that really interested me in this watching. Does that stand out to anybody else?
Yeah, I was interested in that particular relationship because it was the fact that they're different species. They can have a conversation about romance and about relationships between males and females without having it to be about the relationship between us.
Right.
I watched the interactions between them with that in mind the second time through, because I was like, that's obviously not there. I mean, a mouse and a crow aren't going to get together. And yet she bats her eyes at him. She flirts with him a little bit.
Yes.
At several times, I was just not really quite sure what to make of that particular dynamic between the two of them.
She, I think at that point was, I mean, she was playing a card. Like, oh mm-hmm. my goodness, I forgot about what about my children? She's using flattery. I mean, she's manipulating his insecurities.
Yeah, she's taking advantage of the image that he wants to project.
Exactly. So, I mean, he knows that they're not going to capitalize on this as a romantic relationship. He's building a nest for, spoiler alert, a bird. But still, there is something genuine in that. I mean, this wasn't the right thing for her to do, but this guy is insecure and looking for certain things, and he's trying to build a certain image for himself. She exploited that and was able to use this, oh my goodness, my helpless children, and I just didn't think things through, because certainly Martin can't handle himself. I mean, this young boy is going to be flying the Enterprise someday. I mean, he can't possibly manage a home. Y'all knew I was going to do it.
Yeah, I knew it was coming some sooner or later.
But Jeremy is willing to jump right on that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what we're going for here is that there is so much to say about this film. I mean, I have so many notes that I haven't even gotten to. I don't think I could. So I guess the question is, listeners, what have we missed that you would like to call attention to in this film? So reach out to us on Twitter at ArmsGeek, or visit us at Facebook, because we want to hear your reactions to this. Comment on the blog section when we get the show notes posted, because we have so much more we would like to be able to say about this film, but we're not doing a two-parter. We're not, guys, right? We're not doing a two-parter?
No, let's not do that.
That's a negative ghostwriter.
That was definitely a rhetorical question. So does anybody else have any closing thoughts on The Secret of NIMH?
So I really enjoyed watching this movie. Now, this is going to surprise y'all, but I really enjoyed watching this movie for the first time.
No way!
You hadn't seen it before?
I have seen bits and pieces, but I realized when I watched it for this podcast, I had never seen it all the way through.
Well, welcome to the club!
And I was thinking back to my childhood. I'm like, I had to have seen this. And I realized the times I had seen it, it was always at a friend's house when other people were around, and you know, some were watching a movie and some were doing other stuff. And the movie more than once was Secret of NIMH. And I'd catch a little bit of it. I'd go do something else. I'd catch a little more. And I never saw it all the way through until the night before we recorded this episode.
Did you like it?
Very much. I'm looking forward to showing it to my daughter. When I saw it was G, I thought, well, maybe she could watch it with me and I can get her reactions. But I decided to err on the side of caution, because most things that I let her watch, Daddy previews them first.
Mm-hmm.
Mommy or Daddy. And I was glad I did so with this one, because like I said earlier, she watched Spider-Man Far From Home and was perfectly fine. I think she'll be okay with this, but she also has a very tender heart. And there might be a couple of moments where the movie does get to her, but I think it definitely, definitely should have had a PG rating at least.
Yeah, I think so too. Oh, and while we're on this topic, steer her clear for a while of Watership Down.
Oh no, I told my wife last night, because after we got done watching it on Amazon Prime, it popped up with, here's other movies you may be interested in.
No.
I told Joy, you know, I think it'd be fun to watch this with her. She might like... I never really liked An American Tale. I did like Fievel Goes West. I thought my daughter would like that as well. And I looked at her and said, and we are never showing her Watership Down. Ever. Like, Dad, I'm 30 years old now. Can I watch Watership... No.
Oh, man, I remember the first time your wife watched Watership Down, and she hated me for suggesting it to her.
Oh, man. I read the book and parts of that freaked me out. I mean, like, I needed to go walk the dog, and I was desperately scared of getting my neck caught in a snare just because, I mean, that's not a rational fear, but, I mean, man, it was just so alive and almost not on the page.
I'm like, who writes this stuff? And even then, who looks at this and thinks, this would make a great cartoon? Anyway, don't even bother looking it up because I don't care. But it was a great movie and one that I am going to share with my daughter soon and look forward to seeing it again. What about you, gentlemen?
If you've never seen it, see it now. If you've not seen it in a long time, see it again. And if you have seen it recently, see it again anyway.
I mean, I'm just about ready to go watch this movie again. Y'all can come on over.
Sounds good. Well, I think that will wrap up our first episode of our Animated Film Club series. We'll take a break from it for our next episode, but after that, we will be taking a look at the Miyazaki animated classic Spirited Away, and we hope that you'll watch it before the episode so you can... We'll be watching the Miyazaki classic Spirited Away. And after we post the episode, we'll hope you join us online with your thoughts and feelings on the movie as well. And as always, that will lead us straight to our zombie apocalypse plan of the week. Mike, do mice and or rats figure heavily into how we're going to survive the zombie apocalypse this time? Or will there at least be an owl with glowing eyes? Or do
you
we
know,
find
I
out?
Really need to think this through.
Or do we find out that Nim is actually responsible for the zombie apocalypse? Because I would totally buy that.
You know, that should totally have been a thing. Because actually, in our neighborhood, the mice that are in people's homes, there are rumors that they're so hard to trap because they were MIT lab rat escapees.
Wow.
So, like, it can't possibly be true. I actually talked to an MIT lab technician, and she got mad beyond mad at the idea of that. That's just neighborhood folklore, since MIT is just, like, right over there. But
side note, do we ever find out what NIM actually stands for?
National Institute of Mental Health.
Did I miss that?
Yeah, it's a real thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do they mention that in the movie?
Yeah, the farmer's wife explains it to the farmer because she obviously had a background in psychology.
I was too busy watching the rats steal an extension cord. Anyway, back to the zombies.
All right. Back to the zombie apocalypse strategy of the week, even though we only come up with one a month. This time around, it is the revolving door to nowhere. Because one of the things that the zombies are always looking for is a way in, and they will just continue shuffling forward. And this time, they're just going to shuffle forward until they're shuffling their way out. Problem solved.
You know, we could double down on that, because if it's going to do one thing, why not do two things? And since the zombies are pushing this revolving door, we might as well turn it into a generator for electricity.
This is how you're powering your home during the zombie apocalypse.
That's right.
That's beautiful.
Only to find out that we're not getting as many amps as we thought because some field mice underneath the rose bush are siphoning it off.
I could have sworn I put this extension cord somewhere.
Should I go outside and check? Let me look through the window. No, I don't think I should check at all.
Yeah, but the rosebush is doing well. What's up with that?
It's glowing blue. Man, that's a weird species of rose, but whatever.
Yeah, we'll check on that later.
Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode. We want to thank all of you for listening in. Check us out online at geekatarms.com, Facebook at facebook.com/geekatarms. Mike, what's our awesome Twitter handle?
It is at Arms Geek, because, hey, I mean, I love arms and armor, don't you?
Absolutely. So.
Oh, my God.
Also, if you haven't subscribed to us yet on iTunes or Google Play or through the Podbean app, please do so. And on any of those, leave us a like, leave us a review, let us know how we're doing. So from Brian, Mike, and James, we want to say be safe, be blessed, and be geeky.
Thanks for listening to Geek at Arms. Music for this podcast was provided by Incompetech.com. For more, check us out at facebook.com/geekatarms. Give us a like and maybe even subscribe to us on iTunes. That would be awesome.
Pause for truck going by. Or was that a helicopter?
That was a helicopter.
Okay.
It was a truckacopter.
Truckacopter.
I didn't know G.I. Joe was in Los Angeles.
No, it's mask.
Could be both.
Oh my gosh.
Can't tell me that G.I. Joe never had a truckocopter.